supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have an impossibly seasonable question of the week for you this time out, cats and kittens, because it is nearing the end of winter. We hope. We will tell those of you who burn wood for heat in your home what you can and cannot or should not do with your ashes. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, so let's hop right to it at 1-888-346-9499. Marcella, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, Marcella. Where are you?
I'm in Roxborough in Philadelphia.
Okay, the hilly area. What can we do
The Rocky.
Yeah, exactly. That and Manayunk. I don't know how those guys ride their bikes up there every year.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What can we do for Marcella high above the Schuylkill River?
Last year in my garden, I grow lots and lots of stuff, but I decided to do, when you have it above the ground?
Raised beds?
And, yes, raised bed. And I use baskets like milk crates, and I lined them with some of that black tarp. And I had an overrun of spider mites. Okay. And so I used some diatomaceous earth around the pots, you know, to try to get the spider mites under control.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, I have some of that soil left. Can I use that soil? Is that soil still going to be good? I mean,
Am I
going to run into a problem with the spider mites again?
Oh, well, I don't know about the spider mites. Now, you know, you created an interesting container when mm-hmm. you used those old milk crates. I like that idea a lot. That's not a raised bed garden. That's a container garden. But that's a good container. They are plastic, but they're heavy, thick plastic, so it's totally inert. And mm-hmm. I guess the problem is the drainage is, quote, too good. If you're using a nice soil-free mix or anything, too much of it is going to pour
mm-hmm.
out. But you kind of worked against yourself when you put a tarp in there because that way, you destroyed your drainage. And
I'm sorry, when I said it should be, I used not tarps, what do you call it, the barrier?
A weed fabric.
Yeah,
so
mm-hmm.
it had some drainage holes in it.
Yes, uh-huh.
I'm going to suggest, because you had a weird pest breakout, I'm going to suggest you simply use window screening instead. Go to a hardware store or home store, and you can buy window screening in a roll, you know, which people would use to rescreen
mm-hmm.
their windows and stuff. It's not expensive.
Sure.
And I would line it with that. That would be the perfect combination of keeping the soil mix inside and really good
mm-hmm.
drainage.
Okay.
And spider mites. What were you growing that the spider mites attacked?
Actually, it went after a lot of different things. I had some green peppers and some squash, green beans, string beans, peas.
And spider mites. Very small creatures, mite-like, that spun kind of like, not real spider webs, but enough that it looked like them.
Right, yeah, they were terrible. I mean, at first I was thinking, oh, I just have a few of these, and I didn't realize that they were eating out all of, the roots. I had a terrible crop last year.
Spider mites don't get down to the roots. I think one of the things that happened is your soil stayed saturated too much. So you want to improve the drainage in these crates. What are you feeding these plants?
Really, I wasn't doing much. I used one of those, you know, the soil that actually had the fertilizer in it already, and I didn't add anything else.
Right. The bag soils you get from the chemical companies are not the best. They're
mm-hmm.
out there. They're ubiquitous. I mean, you got to look to find one that doesn't have water-holding crystals or chemical fertilizer in it. But if you go to mm-hmm. hipper independent garden centers, not the big box stores, but a hip independent garden center, you can mm-hmm. get a cleaner soil-free mix. Now, I wouldn't worry about yours anymore because any chemicals in it, that they've been finished up. To feed your plants this year, either get a good supply of compost or get one of these fish and seaweed mixes.
Okay.
A little bit of it goes a long way. I really like it to give plants a boost. If you don't have compost, if you know you can't find any good compost, that would be a good thing to feed your plants with. And you would be surprised You improve the drainage, you feed the plants naturally, and these pests may not show back up again.
Okay, that's encouraging because it was terrible last year.
Yeah, just keep moving towards the more natural realm, and sometimes these things are just a one-year thing. They were just in the neighborhood passing by, and they're gone now.
Okay, great.
All right, good luck, Marcella.
All right, thank you so much, Mike.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. How you doing?
I am just ducky today. Tom, how are you, sir?
I am spectacular, Mike.
Whoa, give me some of that. Send some my way. Put it in an envelope.
All right.
Mark it postage due. Where is Tom spectacular?
Spectacular in Seaside Heights, New Jersey.
All right, what can we do for Tom in Seaside Heights?
Well, Mike, about 15 years ago, I purchased and planted Bradford pear trees. I planted two of them. One is not doing as well as the other because over time, you know, kids break branches, or the tree was actually even pulled out to put in a new sewer line.
Right.
So it's had a rough life. The other one is doing fine, and it is starting to get close to the power lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to prune them, especially the bigger one, just to see if I can make them more the same size.
Okay. The skinny on these trees is they are the cheapest trees on God's good earth. They were cheap for you to buy. They are cheap in the sense of being strong in that they're not. They're brittle. They're weak. The reason they're planted so much is they're incredibly easy to grow, and they can be sold for the cheapest price possible. So, for instance, when people are putting in a development or something and they need 2,000 trees, this is by far the best short-term investment.
Right.
But long-term, these things are known for cracking, for splitting, for dropping big limbs. And you have to be careful pruning them because they are so brittle. They can break off while you're working on them. So you say the one is getting close to the power lines. What are the odds that the power company will come and take care of this for you?
I didn't think to ask them.
Oh, man, that's always the first resort. Because if they're anywhere near the power lines, the power company is almost always very anxious to cut them back. Now, they may cut them back a little bit more severely than you like, but they'll come and do the job for free.
Yeah, that's true. But I've always planted trees, and I'm pretty handy, and I like working with the trees and working up in the yard. So I think I want to give it a try.
How high up do you have to get?
They are probably about 20 feet high.
Okay, so you realize this is seriously dangerous work.
A little bit, yeah.
No.
This
is seriously dangerous work. You need a partner. Okay. You can't be up there alone. You both, no joke, have to have hard hats.
Okay.
You know, I used to be a medical writer, and I covered a lot of stories of guys who trimmed trees and took their hard hat off for 1 minute. After that, it was a life of chronic pain and brain injury. So you really, especially with a tree like this, it's already prone to dropping healthy branches. This thing is going to split in ways that you're not used to if you're used to trimming, quote, real trees. So the best time to prune them is right after they flower.
Oh, okay. I've heard you say about pruning trees in the dead of winter, but not for these type of trees.
Oh, no, that's not true. No, you could prune them in the dead of winter. One thing that I would advise against that is it's harder work when your hands are cold and things can be more slippery.
Mm-hmm.
And these are already kind of dangerous trees to be working in. So I would want conditions to be perfect. I would want the wood to be dry. I would want you not to be rushing because you're losing the feeling in your fingers. Plus, you can prune it in the dead of winter, but then you won't see the flowers. That's the only thing these trees really have to offer. And there's no harm in pruning after the flowers. So you wait till the flowers have faded, and then you take your time. And when you're up there, this is critically important. You can't take off a long branch all by itself. So it's going to take you three times as long, but you're not going to get hurt, and you won't kill the tree. Let's say there's a branch that's like 6 feet long, and you want to cut it right next to the trunk. Should you do that, the weight of the branch will swing it, and nobody knows exactly which way it's going to go. It could knock you off the ladder. It could impact people on the ground. More importantly, it will take a hold of the bark and it will strip the bark down as it kind of slides off the tree. You start at the furthest end, you take off a foot and a half, you move in, you take off another foot and a half. As you get close to the tree, you cut off the last piece close to the tree, but there is what's called the branch collar, a donut-shaped area. Instead of cutting flush to the trunk, you want to leave these little donuts still attached to the tree. You cut off these big branches in sections. You take your time. You be careful. You can easily remove one-third of the entire tree without doing it any harm. And for instance, when they flower, you see some dead spots on the one that's had a hard life.
Yeah,
don't be afraid to go over there and prune out dead branches. They don't count for anything. And by pruning them out, you limit the danger of falling branches onto your noggin when you're just walking around the yard.
All right, that sounds good.
All right, so please promise me you're going to be careful.
Absolutely. Safety first.
All right. Good luck, Tom.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate everything, and I really love your show.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will speak at the Haverford Home and Garden Show on Sunday, April 15th at the Bayshore Center in Port Norris, New Jersey on Thursday evening, April 26th, and at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Exton, PA on Saturday, May 12th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Tales of Ash Use Wisely and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, do you burn wood for heat over the winter? Do you have a friend or neighbor who does? If any of those things are true, there's a lot of wood ash somebody is trying to find a good use for. We will talk about the plants that might like to receive it and the ones that shouldn't go near it when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sherry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Sherry. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
How are you, Sherry?
I'm great, Mike. I'm very excited to be talking to you.
Good. And where is Sherry great?
I'm in Ventnor, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Down the shore.
Yeah.
How close is your house to the water?
Well, that's the problem. We're right across the street on the bayside, and we get routinely flooded by
the water in the bay.
I know exactly what you mean. People, when they're watching the Weather Channel and stuff, and they're seeing these waves pounding the shoreline, and they know that that's causing a lot of erosion, and sometimes it'll come up and you know, lick the legs of a beach house or something like that. But those of us who have lived near the water realize the bay just kind of comes up slowly and keeps coming up and floods your landscape and often your house. That's water that just is always a present danger to, you know, get a little high and come in where you don't want it.
That's right. And we got destroyed by Hurricane Sandy, but we raised the house, but our street is really low. And I think it's out basically maybe below level or right at sea level. So anytime there's even a high tide, a moon tide, we get flooded.
That's a
so
drag.
Pretty often. Yeah. The land, it's a salt marsh and should have remained a salt marsh. I kind of feel bad that, you know, we're taking that away from nature. So I was going to ask you about maybe any native plants that you could think of that we could grow there that might do okay in that type of environment.
It sounds like, and I hope this won't be in your lifetime, it kind of sounds to me like nature's going to get that salt marsh back sooner or later, sir.
Yeah, it should. It's trying. It's trying to get it back. This is an area of Ventnor Heights that was developed, probably not the wisest thing for humankind to do.
And not heights enough. It's Ventnor Lows, right? Yeah.
Right. I mean, a height in Ventnor is like 2 feet, so
well,
compared to the rest of Ventnor.
The real answer is exactly what you're saying. The only plants that are really going to survive there are the kind of plants that you would find in a salt marsh. There are some plants, some junipers and stuff, some pines that can survive on the ocean side, you know, because they have to tolerate the occasional, not flooding so much, but being pounded, whereby any plants you have, they're going to need to survive being submerged for pretty long periods of time.
Yeah, and that, I mean, there's down the shore, I'm sure you've noticed, they grow a lot of things like hydrangea and black-eyed Susans and a type of rose, knockout roses. And those do okay, like in normal conditions, but they all died in our yard because they got flooded so often.
Yeah. So a couple things that you should do. The first thing you got to do is you got to talk to your state extension service, your local office, because these seashore plants are very specific. And as I hope we're pointing out to people, very different for oceanside homes as opposed to bayside homes. You really need a different type of plant than if you were facing the ocean. And your local, not only extension office, but your municipality, they may not only have a list of plants, they may have scheduled group plantings where they have people going around to install the plants. Not so much for the good of the homeowner, but for the good of the community to hold the soil in place, to lessen erosion. And they'll know the plants that can survive with the bay right behind you like that. And then your state extension service will have lists of plants. This is so specific that I'm not even going to name a single one off the top of my head because I could be wrong. And I know more. I don't know a lot about the entire subject, but I know more about the ones that might be able to do well on the ocean, you know, the dunes that they put in, the dune plants. And I've seen near Asbury Park, there is a beautiful, I call it an ocean rose. It's a shrub rose. It looks like it belongs outside of Sleeping Beauty's castle. It's amazing. It just is all over the place. And during the summer, for a fairly long period of time, it's covered with beautiful little roses. But again, that's on the beach side. The bay side is going to be trickier. But there are things you can plant there. You should plant it as densely as you possibly can. And like I said, your state extension service is going to have lists and suggestions and things to avoid and things to consider utilizing. But your municipality may want to enter you, for lack of a better word, into a program where maybe they can come and do a whole number of houses at the same time so that everybody's on the same page and we're restoring some of the natural order that was lost.
Yeah, but the state may have some resources.
Exactly. You're reading my mind because you should start with Ventnor, but you should also consider the entire state of New Jersey. And when you lock into your local state extension office, that office will be connected with the entire New Jersey State Extension. But you want the knowledge of that local office of these beachfront areas. If you don't get what you're looking for, think of other places that have large back bays. Think of like the Virginia Beach area, south of Virginia Beach, places like Sandbridge and Pungo that have very similar situations that have these large back bays with houses on them. You may find the best list of plants there.
Yeah, but you think I should try to plant something native or something that would be adapted to that environment? Because I've thought about maybe just doing rocks.
No. The more you can put out there with plants in the ground, really, the better you're going to feel and the safer your house is going to be. And rocks are just going to give mosquitoes more places to breed.
Oh, yeah. That's
They're just going to hold the water. You want plants that are going to keep their roots in the soil, hold the soil in place as much as possible. All right?
Okay. I'll try some, beach plum, I've heard of, maybe coastal panic grass.
Don't do anything on your own. Make sure it's the right thing for the situation first. A little research could go a long way here. All right. Well, we're losing Sherry. We're losing your reception. So I'll just say goodbye.
That's okay.
These things happen. All right. Good luck to you.
It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Amanda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike / Dad.
Hey, Amanda, everybody out there. This is the legendary Amanda McGrath, who keeps our Facebook page fresh. What can I do for you, honey? You're not supposed to call me at work.
Well, I actually have a question for you, and I'm not anywhere in the area. So I was hoping you could help me with either termites or carpenter ants. Maybe neither, hopefully.
Oh, okay, sure. I know that you're down in Virginia, and you're staying with a friend. So does the friend have some sort of structural pest issue?
Well, yesterday we found a couple just looked like little flying ants, nothing that bugged us in the living room next to the kitchen. And then this morning, out from underneath the fridge, just not a constant stream, but it didn't really stop. We kept finding them. And we pulled the fridge out, and there was a pile of what looked like really fine wood shavings. We couldn't get actually back there.
Okay.
Based on the layout of the house. And then, I don't know if it was a nest, but it looked almost like a brown sponge that had, like, holes in it, but not like honeycomb holes.
Right. Well, termites do swarm. I don't know that there are many recorded stories of them swarming underneath a refrigerator, but it makes sense because they are creatures of moisture. You know, all refrigerators need to get rid of excess water, and they have drains and they tend to have pans underneath. So if there's a drainage problem with this fridge, which is incredibly common, the tubes that carry the condensed water out, just like in an air conditioner, a fridge needs to drip, drip, drip all the time.
The ground was totally dry, though.
Okay, good.
Behind the fridge.
Good, good. But it's still a good place for them because it's cool and dark and damp back there. Now, did you get a good look at one of these flying creatures? Because the difference between a flying ant and a termite is the waste.
And that's what we were afraid of. We were looking online, which, you know, always helps. We ended up looking at things in Australia.
Yeah, of course.
But the bodies were pretty much the same throughout, with like kind of narrow, that's what I was afraid of, with a kind of flat wings that went pretty much just covered the body but didn't stick out too far.
Flying ants have what's called like a wasp-like waist, where the body is defined clearly into two parts with a real skinny middle, and termites have a kind of a thick, continuous body.
Okay, so going on that, they have two kids under five in that house.
Oh, no, the termites are no danger to humans, and it takes them 10, 20, 30 years to do any structural damage to the house. There's absolutely no reason to panic or to think of any kind of insecticides. Now, in the area you're in, most places do not have basements. Is there a cellar or a basement underneath this?
No.
Okay. The answer is, as with many pest problems, the answer is not to spray anything because there is a colony. It's in the soil underneath the house. And the termite queen is living in that colony. And as you know, the queen of just like an ant colony can lay, you know, millions of eggs over her lifetime. and she's protected from anything that happens inside the house because it's only the workers who come into the house who are chewing the wood. They take food back to her, and she pumps out more young, and then they join the army. So there are several ways, all of which are non-toxic and safe for the kids, to trick the workers into taking bait back to the queen that is amazingly non-toxic to humans, but is deadly to termites over a period of time. Same as with ants. We're talking some version of boron, B-O-R-O-N, like boric acid. You can buy boron-treated wood. In homes in areas where there's a lot of termite infestations, the builder will actually insert rods of treated wood into the regular building material as they're building the house. So if termites get involved in the framing, they encounter one of these dosed rods, for lack of a better word, treated rods, and they take the boric acid back to the queen with the rest of the wood supply. But boric acid works so slowly, the workers themselves who ate the wood first, they don't die for 7 to 10 days, which is good because all this time then they're feeding it to the queen. And shortly after the workers begin to die off, the queen is poisoned by the boric acid. And when she dies, the whole colony collapses, and that's it for this termite invasion. So there's two ways right away I can think of that this can be attacked. One is you get boron-treated wood and have somebody who's a good woodworker, somebody who has some skill, or talk to people at a lumber yard and have them plane it down so that it can go right where they are, so that maybe it could be like a piece of plywood underneath the fridge, or have somebody who's a good carpenter come and take out the damaged wood, which is always a good idea, and replace it with borax-treated wood. And then outside the house, you can get bait stations. I think you can get these at home improvement stores. The pest control companies will install them if you insist, but you can also buy them yourself. And these are things that you plunge into the ground that have an opening that's above ground with a flip-top cap, and you put in treated wood. And below ground, there's entrances for the termites to come and go into the traps. So you put the treated wood into these traps. The termites go into the trap underground, take the treated wood back underground to the colony, and that kills the queen. You know my friend Bill Quarles, right? The guy who does the IPM practitioner and Common Sense Pest Control Journal. He's been an advisor to the show and me for longer than I care to relate. He has done extensive work on termites, and these outdoor bait stations are 95% effective at getting rid of termite infestations very quickly. They're much more effective than chemical trenches around the house. There's no reason to spray insecticide inside the house. That's not where the problem is. The problem is underground somewhere. And you'll
what
never.
What about that spongy thing?
I don't know. Just wrap it in a plastic bag and throw it out in the trash and try not to think of it again.
It looks like it's attached to the wall, so we were worried if we like moved it that termites would just spew out and turn into this like horror movie cloud.
But
we're a little dramatic.
It could. It would not be a lot of termites with wings. It would be what looks like maggots, the larval form, which is, you know, horror movie material. But
absolutely,
you don't
so. Just leave it.
Yeah, you don't need an exterminator. You need a carpenter. You need a handyman to come and remove the damaged wood and replace it with wood treated with borax, boron, boric acid. They'll know what we're talking about. And then do the outdoor bait stations, and there's no potential harm whatsoever to the children you've mentioned, and it is virtually guaranteed that the termites will be destroyed. Now, I shouldn't have to tell you this, but you should go to the website, youbetyourgarden.org, click on where we have Garden Answers A to Z, and go to T for termites, and all of this is outlined. Now, your situation is a little different. I've never heard of a colony being discovered when a refrigerator was moved, but it's probably going to be a lot more minor than you and your friend think. It takes termites a long time to cause any noticeable damage. So the one thing you don't want to do, no matter who tells you anything, is you don't want to spray any chemicals inside the house. There's no reason to kill off these workers. You need the workers alive to take the treated wood back to the queen. that's in the nest. And maybe your friend should talk to the neighbors and say, you should put these bait stations up too, because obviously there's some termite issues. The part of Virginia you're in is pretty well known for termites.
Another good thing to know.
I'm so glad you called, because obviously I don't want chemicals being sprayed around you, my child, as much as other children. And we will have saved probably hundreds of people from spraying poisons inside their house for no good reason.
Well, and, you know, she is very organic-minded and was horrified at the idea that we might, quote-unquote, have to.
Yes, exactly. No. The researchers I talked to, even back in my days at Organic Gardening, said people panic when they see problems with termites or carpenter ants, and there's absolutely no reason to panic. You've got years to take care of this.
That is exactly what we needed to hear here.
All right. You have fun while you're there. Tell your friend to relax. Take care of the problem. It's no worse than a broken pipe, and everything will be fine.
That is wonderful. We're about to go to the store now.
Okay. Good luck, honey.
All right. Thanks, Dad.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear in beautiful Cortez, Colorado on Saturday, May 19th as part of their Tez Talk series. Yes, that Colorado podcast, pals. Then I'm off to the legendary Chautauqua Institute, where I will speak at noon on Monday, July 30th and Tuesday, July 31st. That's at Chautauqua in upstate New York. But don't go looking for all the globe-trotting details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Tales of Ash Use Wisely and more of your wise phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will talk about the wise and unwise ways to use all of those ashes that people with wood-burning stoves have accumulated over the winter. Don't dare spread that ash without hearing our wise words. In front of those wise words, a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Pam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call question.
Oh, thank you for making it, Pam. Where are you?
I'm in West Grove, PA.
And is that just outside of Philly?
Yeah, about an hour.
Which way?
Near Kennett Square.
Near Kennett Square, down by Longwood Gardens. And
yes.
Yeah, you got a lot of great places to visit down there. What can we do for
you? Yes. So I had a question. We just recently moved into a house in October of this year, and we had an issue when it was a little bit warmer with fungus gnats,
mm-hmm.
I think they were. And the neighbors said they get them like every year in the season, and they just like get into the house. And we have flowers planted around the house, but we are not gardeners at all. So we have no idea what we have or what to do. And we just don't know how to take care of the issue, or like, I don't know if I should take some plants out or keep what we got or what to plant new. I don't know what to do.
One of the banes of gardening is the springtime gnats, especially as you get towards more wild areas, areas with, you know, watersheds nearby, that little ponds, vernal pools. We had a lot of water in our area over the wintertime, so we're going to have a lot of water pooling in the spring, and we're going to have a lot of mosquitoes and fungus gnats. So one thing you can do, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the details, but I want you to go to our website. I want you to go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on Garden Answers A to Z. And you're welcome to look at fungus gnats, but it's not really specific to your problem. I want you to go to the mosquito control articles.
Okay.
Because what you're going to do is you're going to go out and you're going to buy a natural substance called BTI. You're going to get it either in donut form, little donuts. Maybe you've seen them in hardware stores.
Okay.
And it also comes in granular form. I would suggest you load up on it in both forms. Even right now, put out buckets of water or cat food cans filled with water or pint containers from like a takeout restaurant place. And treat them all with BTI and surround your home with them. They're not fungus gnats. Fungus gnats are a related creature that lives in the soil of houseplants indoors. These are more like, I guess you'd call them outdoor gnats. I'm not sure what the correct term is. But what you want to do is stop their breeding right away. The females, I do believe they take a blood meal. So sometimes when they're all over our eyes and stuff, they're actually sucking out small quantities of blood. Then the female looks for water in which to lay her eggs. So I want you to have a lot of water outside, but water that's treated with BTI. It's an all-natural soil-dwelling organism that's been adapted for use in controlling mosquitoes and other members of the fly family that breed in water. So that includes black flies, which you might also have a problem with in your new landscape.
Do.
Yeah. That includes black flies, mosquitoes, and these annoying springtime gnats. So the more BTI treated water you put outside, the more you're going to cut their numbers down early in the season. You may be amazed if you really keep at this and you freshen up the granules once a week and you freshen up any busted up bits of the donuts every 3 weeks or so, you can really knock them completely out of your landscape.
That would be awesome. I am so getting on that. Okay.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with your plants. Your plants are a false trail. This is just a question of there's a lot of water on your property and around your property, and they
It doesn't drain well, so that's an issue. So that's probably why.
Okay, good. So I'm glad you pointed that out. So hit them with the BTI right now. Get started right away. And then in the fall, arrange for your lawn or yard to have a core aeration done where they pull plugs out of the soil.
Yes, we were thinking about that.
Yeah, that'll improve the drainage. That'll also reduce their numbers. You know, the more you do to keep your landscape dry and with BTI traps to... Hi, kids. to keep their numbers down, the more they'll be in your neighbor's house and not yours.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for the information. And I'm definitely going to check the website out, too.
Yeah, look under mosquitoes and then core aeration for lawns. I think.
All righty. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck with the kid.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Steven, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing?
I am just Ducky Steven. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing fine.
And where is Steven doing fine?
Yancey County, North Carolina.
Where is that in the state?
It's about 30 minutes outside of Asheville.
Okay, very good. Anywhere near the ocean?
Oh, no, we're off in the mountains.
Oh, okay.
We're on the western coast.
Oh, okay. Now I know where you are. It's a beautiful country up there in the hills, man.
Oh, yeah.
All right. What can we do for Steven in mountainous North Carolina?
Here in Yancey, we have a community dig-in garden that provides some food to those in need throughout the county. as being a recipient in the past of that assistance, now that I'm, you know, a little bit better off, I'm looking for a way to give back to an organization that helped me. And I've been doing a lot of research on hydroponic gardening. And I was wanting to get your input on, you know, is it as effective as what I'm reading? And if so, what's the biggest things to look out for?
Hydroponics, they're kind of the opposite of my specialty, because organic gardening, the kind of organic gardening I espouse, is all about building up the soil, and healthy soil equals healthy plants. Hydroponic gardening is a very artificial way of growing plants in water, plants that normally would grow in soil. It is a very expensive to set up. You really need to keep that water super clean. As of the last time I checked, it wasn't possible, or it would be incredibly difficult, to feed the plants organically. All hydroponic systems that I'm aware of use diluted chemical fertilizer in the water. And hydroponics tends to be indoors, so you've got a building, and the plants need as much or more light than they would get outside. So we're talking about a building that's made entirely of insulated glass, or we're using high-intensity lights right above the plants to provide extra lighting. On a small scale, I doubt you can get your money back, if you know what I mean. I think you could go to the store and buy the vegetables probably for a third of the price, even if you amortized it over like 10 years. Why hydroponic as opposed to outside?
The fact that hydroponics, if done right, you know, can produce throughout the winter, and that's when the community digging garden is not able to provide, you know, fresh grown stuff for those in each of the counties. And that's kind of what I'm looking for, a year-round source of food.
I think that it can be done either in the garden or in another garden, as opposed to hydroponic. Do you know what your agricultural zone is, your USDA zone?
I think we're in zone 6, I believe.
Because you're at elevation somewhat.
Yes.
Yeah. You could grow salad greens. You could grow spinach. You could grow lettuces. You could grow many root crops. You could grow potatoes and radishes and beets. Almost anything that's not a true tropical plant. You couldn't do tomatoes or peppers over the winter. But there are many nutritious things that you could grow over the winter. You might be able to get a grant. There may be grants in your state to erect what are called hoop houses.
Okay.
And these are big structures that, you know, a guy can walk into. The ceilings tend to be about 8 or 10 feet high. And it's just stretched clear plastic over a frame with doorways on each end.
Yeah.
But they're really good at maintaining heat and, you know, keeping out the worst of the winter weather, so that even passively, that's without any kind of electricity involved, you can grow those cool weather crops I mentioned all throughout the winter in a hoop house. And a lot of states will actually pay or subsidize the erection of a hoop house for programs like this, or even for small-scale farmers who are working for a profit. I have friends here in Pennsylvania. I've helped them put up a couple of hoop houses that they've received state grants to cover some of the funding for. And so I see these things produce all winter long. I can go over to my friend's farm, and most of the time I can cut some fresh lettuce and salad greens and spinach and pick a couple of radishes for myself in January or February.
Okay.
You can also do it on a smaller scale. You can have a nice big raised bed, say it's 4 foot wide by like maybe 20 feet long. And then you can get what are called row covers for that. And you would just cover that growing bed with this heavy-duty row cover fabric. It traps heat during the day and keeps the plants warm at night.
Okay.
All right, man. So go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Click on where it says Garden Answers A to Z and read the stuff on season extension. You'll be surprised at how much you can do without buying a lot of equipment.
All right.
All right, Steve.
right, thank you.
Well, thank you too, man, for giving back. That's a great idea, and I think it's really important for us to be growing this nice, healthy food, making sure it's available through food banks.
All right.
All right, good luck, sir.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. How much ash should a gardener use if a gardener could use ash? Alexis Landis, who occasionally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, could you get us started with this week's question?
I never get a break, do I?
Nope, not a single one.
Well, Bob in Wardensville, West Virginia, has a question that is short but sweet. He writes, I've got a lot of wood ashes and wonder if I can use them in the garden. And if so, where?
Huh, short and sweet. That's really clever, Alexis. Hardwood ashes from a wood-burning stove are very alkaline, and old-time farmers would use ashes to, quote, sweeten a sour soil, as alkaline soil tastes a little sweet, and a soil that's acidic tastes sour.
Oh, I didn't know that. It's just nice when someone around here writes a sentence that doesn't take up 12 lines.
Time check. Time check. What was that? 35 seconds. That might be a new record for us to go sour. And you people thought the Olympics were over.
Yeah, yeah. Time to stop stalling and start answering. After all, this is the time of year when people who burn wood for heat have a lot of wood ash. And they're really hoping that there's a good use for it in the landscape.
Right. Luckily, the people who burn the most wood are also the ones who can probably use the largest amounts of ash safely in their landscape. That's people in cold weather regions. In general, people who have cold winters and or a lot of rain tend to have soils that are on the acidic side. That's great for growing plants that require an acidic soil.
Like blueberries, azaleas, rhododendrons, camellias.
Right. All the usual suspects. Depending on how acidic your soil is, those plants may need to have their pH lowered a bit more with a mulch of peat moss, some added sulfur, or a product like Holytone that acidifies the soil while providing a natural feeding.
And we should mention that Espoma, the company that makes Holytone, underwrites the national syndication of our show.
Yeah, they've also been a premier source of natural fertilizers and soil amendments for close to 100 years now, and they shouldn't be penalized for making it easier for people in Dayton and Oklahoma City to hear the show on broadcast radio.
Okay, disclaimer done. Now, it's important for people to remember that wood ashes should never go near plants that require an acidic soil. It always surprises me how many people get it backwards and think that wood ashes make soil more acidic.
Hey, dyslexia is its own reward. Or maybe it's Lex Luthor is his own dew point. Or,
I can't believe I have to be the grown-up in the room again.
If it happens all the time, you shouldn't be surprised. Nah.
Ugh, you would test the patience of Mr. Rogers. Anyway, this is where a soil test can be incredibly useful, specifically any test that reveals the pH of the soil, right?
Absolutely. And that's never more true than with a lawn. Most lawn grasses grow best in a slightly acidic to neutral soil. That's a pH of 6.5 to 7.
High numbers greater than 7 are alkaline. Numbers lower than 7 are acidic.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Now, if your lawn soil tests acidic, you can and should raise the pH to the optimum level using wood ash instead of the often recommended agricultural lime, as ash also contains good amounts of phosphorus, calcium, and other nutrients. And the whole point of this article is to help people who got 55-gallon drums of this stuff get rid of some of it.
The calcium carbonate equivalency of wood ash is slightly lower than lime, so you would use 1.3 times as many pounds of ash per 1,000 square feet of turf than the recommended amount of lime. A nice, easy calculation. But what about in the garden?
You know, there are some crops, like peas and beans, that actually prefer a, quote, sweet soil. I always dust a little wood ash into the soil of these crops at planting time. Boxwoods, despite being evergreens, require an alkaline soil and struggle in acidic conditions. So again, a little bit of wood ash can be a big help to them. Folks who burn a lot of wood should search legitimate state extension and university websites for lists of other plants that like it sweet. Don't depend on posts from fellow gardeners. You could easily wind up with the dyslexic blues.
You often recommend small amounts of rock phosphate to improve blooming and underperforming plants. Can you use wood ash to add extra phosphorus to their soil instead?
Absolutely. But as we always try and stress when we mention rock phosphate, less is more. We're talking a quarter to half a cup of wood ashes per good-sized plant. And because minerals like phosphorus are released slowly over time, you should only add this amendment every 3 to 4 years.
As with any soil amendment, cover the material with some compost or garden soil to help it become more quickly available to the plants in question.
Absolutely. And finally, you can also add wood ashes to nitrogen-rich composted manures to balance out their nutrient content. Use a good amount of ash for composted horse manure and an even larger amount with chicken manure, which is the most nitrogen-rich of the barnyard manures. Mix the ashes well into the manure and let the mixture sit a week or two before using it anywhere near plants. Well, those sure were some interesting options for dealing with your ashes of wood, now wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to ash my azaleas if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. Our needs are great and mysterious and not well understood by you. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our priceless podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Please check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page and like us. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowis keep our website ashen. Our associate producer of production association is Brett Rader. Burnt Out Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is Blooming Al Banks. I'm phosphorus-rich Mike McGrath. And did you know that the ashes that Catholics get applied to their forehead on Ash Wednesday are actually made from the burnt remains of the plants that were left over from the previous year's Palm Sunday services? Pretty cool, huh? End of the show, you finally learned something. I'll be back with even more fascinating facts next week. Ornamental grasses make great privacy screens. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss which ones work best and how to safely prune them. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden.